Someone called me today, a woman who actually used to work for the JSN, and she told me that her grandmother died many years ago, and the yard site, the day that she died, is tonight. And she asked, what's appropriate to do for the yard site of her grandmother? So the first thing that came to my mind is to sponsor my class. So I said, how about you sponsor the class tonight? So she said, okay, how much? So I said, listen, I know her mother wanted to sponsor the class. I said, listen, I know your mother is into horses. Figure out what it costs to feed a horse for a month. And about that. So that's what she did. I think this class was $20 less than it costs to feed a horse for a month, but we're pretty close. The topic tonight is obviously a very heavy topic. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. The reason I announced it is I wanted to say it's in honor of her grandmother, Rachel Bas Aryeh Leib, and that her soul should have an aliyah. The topic for the class tonight is all men are created equal, women too. So either that's women too, the way Ray Felsen said it, or women too. What I'd like to discuss tonight is topics that are very dear to people's hearts, whether they're male or female, and that is trying to understand the equality or sometimes lack of equality in religious practice. Now, this class is a very challenging class because, as one can imagine, it's coming from a perspective or coming from default positions that are not 2011 United States of America. You're coming from default positions where women did not always have the same rights, the same social rights, the same economic rights that they have today. And therefore, as the halacha develops, it becomes a challenge to try to deal with some of the issues. Now, if I told you that you're going to walk out of this class having all your questions answered and having no issues with halacha, with Torah, and feminism, or no issues with understanding what a woman's role should be and feeling perfectly comfortable with that, I would be lying, because understanding or kind of pushing the envelope on the woman's role in Judaism is a process. It's not something which occurs overnight, because again, the default position is not 2011 United States of America. We're starting with a system that is much older than that and didn't always give women the same rights that they have nowadays. Yet, we have to understand that women are not considered to be any less than men in terms of Judaism, in terms of their connection to God, or things of that sort. But when it plays out in practice, when it plays out in actually doing things or not doing things, there are different roles and there are different agendas. Now, I'd like to lay down the assumptions of this class, because without laying down the assumptions, I think we may not be speaking the same language. At least, you may not agree with some of the assumptions, but at least if we put down the assumptions, you'll understand the perspective that I'm coming from, and hopefully walk away with a better understanding of why the Torah says this, or why women can't do that, or are exempt from something else. So let's start with the assumptions. And again, you may not agree with the assumptions. It would be similar if I would start off a class in mathematics. Of course, everyone knows 2 plus 2 is 4, but if I would start off a class in mathematics with the assumption that 2 plus 2 is 5, I would ask you to then, whether you agree with that assumption or don't agree with that assumption, to assume that, at least for the duration of the class, so that we can then pull out what we need to as we deal with this topic. After you leave and you start going through it in your mind, you may have issues with the assumptions and you may have questions on the assumptions, and that's all fair and that's all legitimate, but at least to get through the class, if we can just make these assumptions default. They're not crazy assumptions, they are at least what I consider to be fair assumptions. The first is, we can try to understand God, we can try to understand Hashem, why he did things certain ways, whether it's men and women issues, whether it's issues in the other issues in the Torah, but God is not in trial. We have to understand that we are creatures that were created by God, and God was the one who decided to do things a certain way and not do things some other way. There are realities that sometimes we have to struggle with, that God made me the way I am. I'm not happy about certain things, I am happy about other things, but one way or the other, there's nothing I can do to change it. We're not here to put God on trial and say, if I understand why it is this way or why it isn't this way, then I'll go, you know, then God is good. And if I don't understand why it is this way or why it isn't this way, then God is bad. We're not here to try God. We're here to understand a little bit better the divine, God's ways and his approach in terms of setting up the system as he did. That's assumption number one. Assumption number two is a very important assumption, and that is we are not going to make major differentiations between what it says in the text of the Torah and what it says in the text of the Talmud, which means that the assumption is that the Talmud is not the Torah, it's not the written Torah, but it's an interpretation of the written Torah, and it's an interpretation of the written Torah that is responsible for the traditional Judaism that we have today. Judaism cannot be understood and cannot be practiced in any way if one would just follow the written Torah. Without the oral Torah, Judaism would look something completely different than anything anyone practices. It's only because we have an oral Torah that we know what an esrog is supposed to look like, that it's not supposed to look like an apple, and it's only through the written Torah that we know what a matzah is supposed to look like and not look like be something else. It's only through the oral Torah and the oral tradition that we're able to have much of the practice, almost all of the practice that we have nowadays. So the assumption is that the rabbis of the Talmud are not wrong. They may have been dealing with a different time in history. Their rules that they set up, the principles that they set up, are considered to be the Torah's principles. The way it applied then may not be exactly the way it applies nowadays. Some things are entitled to evolve and some things are entitled to change. Not the principles in terms of their interpretation of what the Torah says, but rather how it can be applied nowadays. Ramosha Feinstein was one of the most famous, for good reason, authorities on Jewish law in the past generation, and he has a section where he deals with feminism. About 30 or 40 years ago. About 40 years ago, someone raised the question that feminism is becoming very popular. It's becoming and it's moving beyond the social and economic realm. It's moving into the realm of religion. And the question was how to deal with feminism as it moves into the realm of Judaism, as it moves into the realm of religion. And interestingly, the first thing that he does in his response in dealing with this question is articulating the importance of rabbinic, or we shouldn't call it rabbinic law, but Talmudic law. Explaining that, according to our tradition, when we say at the beginning of Pirkei Avot that Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, Moshe received the Torah at Har Sinai, it wasn't just the written Torah that Moshe received from God at Har Sinai, but it was the oral Torah that Moshe received from Har Sinai as well, meaning a certain amount of tradition that was certainly expanded and dealt with in great length by the rabbis of the Talmud, and it wasn't simple. There's plenty of arguments, but the basic oral tradition is also a tradition from Moshe miSinai. Now, why would Moshe Feinstein feel that this is something which is necessary to do when he starts a tshuva, when he starts a response on feminism? Why would he have to start off by saying, "Remember that the Torah was given from God, and the oral Torah that we have is also given from God"? The reason is because the tendency of an agenda such as feminism, which may not be bad in certain areas, is to undermine. Which means that if I see that women are not allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, so the tendency is going to be to undermine that. There is no reason women should not be allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. The law has to change. And we'll do what we need to change the law. They'll make June 17th, a day where women are going to jump into cars and start driving, and they're going to protest through their actions. They're going to protest by doing what they do. It's an important way, and probably the only way to get the equality that they're looking for, or at least some semblance of the equality that they're looking for. When it comes to women voting, when it came to the developments of many things throughout American history, one has to undermine. One has to go and say, this is not fair, this doesn't make sense. And that's the approach. That is an appropriate approach in social areas or in legal areas. When you're trying to establish a country and you're trying to say there shouldn't be differentiations between men and women in terms of the pay scale. Okay, these are all legitimate and proper approaches to deal with the restrictions that are imposed by the society. However, when it comes to religion, it's much more dangerous. You see, when feminism creeps into religion, it has to be done much more carefully. Why? Because you're not going against American law. You're not necessarily going against social law. You're going against, or possibly going against, God's law. And therefore, he was very concerned that if one would take the same approach that one takes in dealing with everything else, which is, let's fight it until we win, well, it works in everything else, and it's the proper approach in everything else. But it's not the proper approach here, because if that's the approach in religion, you can be deviating and swaying far away from what God wanted to be done under certain circumstances, just because you're pursuing an agenda of equality. So, to me, it seems that's why it was necessary, he felt it necessary, to begin his response by laying down his assumptions, and that is that Torah was given to Moshe Mitzrayim. The Torah is perfect. The written Torah is perfect. The oral Torah is perfect. It may apply a little bit differently. It may develop. It may evolve. But ultimately, the principles that are in the Torah are God-given. Now, the third assumption that we're going to be making tonight is that when we question things, we have different approaches in questioning. Sometimes we question to understand, and sometimes we question to undermine. For example, when a person is sitting in class and the science teacher is saying that a cell has a nucleus, one can question and say, I can't see that nucleus. Where is that nucleus? I don't believe there is a nucleus. Well, you can ask the question and say, how can you prove to me there's a nucleus to a cell? Or you could ask the question in a way where you're undermining and trying to delegitimize the assumption, which is that a cell has a nucleus. Now, when it comes to reality, our tendency is not to undermine. Our tendency is to understand. For example, if I would tell you that there are men in this world who would like to carry babies. They'd like to be able to get pregnant, and they'd like to carry babies. They would feel that it would be something which would create a bond. You know, I remember when we had our first child, the doctor said something to the effect where the mother grows attached to the child by conception, and the father grows attached to the child when he's three. So there may be a father who would say, I also want to carry a child. I also want to have that bond that only a mother is going to have, that closeness that only a mother is going to have with a child. Now, what would you do? Who are you going to lobby against? Who are you going to, you know, which city hall are you going to be knocking down the doors of when you lobby for the idea of wanting to be able to carry a child? The answer is, it's a recognized reality. It's just an impossibility for a man to be able to do that. And therefore, when you approach it, if it does bother you, you would approach it from a very different perspective. Instead of trying to be able to carry a child, you would probably try to understand, why is it that God made me in a way where I can't possibly carry a child, and what can I do to kind of make up for it? What can I do to try to develop that relationship in some other way with my baby that won't involve actually carrying the baby inside of me for 9 months? So when it comes to this topic as well, I think it's important to take the approach, at least for the duration of this class, to take the approach that if there are halakhic realities, we have to view them as realities as anything else. Which means that if the Torah says something, or if the rabbis of the Talmud understood something from the Torah as a principle, then we're forced to accept it as a principle of the Torah. And then we can try to understand, well, why is it that way? It doesn't make sense. It's not fair. Well, it's not fair is a dangerous question, because it's not fair is an undermining question. We can try to understand, well, why is it that way, and what can be done to compensate for it, because it doesn't make sense that God would create a world where, what, men are going to be closer to God than women? That doesn't make sense. And therefore, we can ask this, the very same questions that are bothering us without using those questions to undermine the reality, but rather to understand why it is that God set up a certain system in a certain way, and what the approach should be to try to compensate for whatever it is that one would feel they're missing because they're either exempt from this or not allowed to do that. Okay. What I did now, so those are the three assumptions. So again, assumption number one is that God's not on trial. Assumption number two is that the Torah is what it is, and the Torah is God-given, including the oral Torah. And assumption number three is that halacha becomes a reality like anything else, and therefore the approach when we ask is to understand and not to undermine. With these three assumptions, now let's move on and try to struggle with things that are much more, the more difficult questions. I have some of them down here. I'll open up the floor a little bit to see what's bothering you, meaning what is it that's on your mind, because when people read the title of this class, they probably had something on their mind that they wanted to answer in this class. And again, I can't guarantee you it will be answered, but at least we can take an approach, we can begin the process of struggling within and trying to understand a little bit better. So the questions that will be addressed, or that I'd like to address, are first of all, why do we find that women are exempt from many mitzvot in the Torah? There are many mitzvot. The rule basically is that time-bound positive mitzvot. Negative mitzvot, all women are obligated in. When the mitzvah is not time-bound, all women are obligated in, and there's no distinction between men and women at all. When it comes to particularly time-bound positive mitzvos, mitzvos that require action within a certain time frame, the halacha is, the Talmud says, that women, the Talmud learns out from the Torah, this is not the rabbis exempting, but rather the Talmud understands that the Torah exempts women from these types of mitzvos. The question is, why? Now, women are allowed to do these mitzvos. When they do these mitzvos, they're rewarded for doing these mitzvos as men are rewarded for doing these mitzvos. But they're exempt from doing these mitzvos. So this is something which is often a question that's raised. Why is it that the Talmud would, or the Torah, we'll call it, would exempt women from certain mitzvos, and men are going to be obligated in those mitzvos? For example, the mitzvah of putting on tefillin in the morning. That's a mitzvah that men are obligated in and women are exempt from. The mitzvah of shaking a lulav and an esrog on the holiday of Sukkot. That's a mitzvah that men are obligated in and women are exempt from. The mitzvah of shofar and Rosh Hashanah. These are all... most of the holiday-related ones are mitzvahs that a woman is exempt from and a man is obligated in. There are exceptions to the rule, and we're not here to give the whole all the details. For example, the mitzvah of making kiddush on Shabbos, there's no distinction between men and women. There are exceptions to the rule, even though that is a time-bound positive mitzvah. So we're not here to kind of give, we're not here to discuss time-bound positive mitzvahs, but try to understand the concept as to why it would be that the Torah would exempt women from some of these mitzvahs, including the mitzvah of Torah study. Torah study is not particularly a time-bound positive mitzvah, yet the Talmud has a special source to say that women are exempt from the mitzvah of Torah study. Now that seems particularly strange, because the mitzvah of Torah study should be something that everyone is obligated to do, because everyone's got to keep it. Meaning everyone's got to know what to do, everyone has got to be able to keep the Torah, and therefore everyone should be obligated in the mitzvah of studying Torah equally. Why would it be that, or what does it mean, better yet, that women are exempt from the mitzvah of Torah study? So that's question 1A, we'll call it. Why do women not count for a minyan? Similar type of a question. When we try to make a minyan, the halacha is that one would need 10 men. Why would that be? Why would that be that a woman cannot count to be part of this women? And a question that always bothers, why are there no Orthodox women rabbis? Why are women not able to be rabbis in Orthodox circles? So that's something which we'll touch on. We're not going to get, that might need an entirely separate class to discuss a completely separate issue. We probably won't get too far with that tonight, but at least to raise it as a question which certainly has to be asked. Okay, moving down. You may be aware of this, you may not be aware of this, but in a Jewish court, testimony of a woman is not admissible. A woman is not allowed to testify in a standard Jewish court. That seems very wrong, because that seems that women are not trusted, women are not believed, women are considered to be liars. Why would the Torah not allow a woman to testify in a Jewish court? So that is question number two, which can be almost said as a statement. If testimony of a woman is unacceptable in a Jewish court, obviously the Torah doesn't trust women. How can that be? That's issue number two. Issue number three. Why do we find that sometimes the rabbis of the Talmud degrade women? For example, we find in the Talmud that there's a blessing that a man makes every morning. Baruch atah Hashem, blessed is God, shelo asani isha, who did not make me into a woman. That seems very derogatory. That seems very demeaning. Why would it be that there would be such a blessing, shelo asani isha, that God did not make me into a woman? Number four. Why are the laws of modesty so biased against women? We don't find that the Torah imposes, or the rabbis of the Talmud impose, laws of modesty in such a severe way on men, yet on women, there are such severe laws of modesty to the point where it doesn't seem fair. That's a question that needs to be answered as well. And number five, this is more of a general question. Why must a woman stifle her passion to play a more active role in Judaism? If a woman has a passion and a woman is motivated to do something and to grow and to become closer to God, why are there so many obstacles in her way? Why are there so many things standing in her way, set up by presumably the rabbis of the Talmud, God himself, that stop her from reaching this goal? How is this passion supposed to be expressed? Where is it supposed to be channeled, and what is she supposed to do in order to play out this passion and this drive that she has to come close to God? Let's pause here for a moment, and if there's anyone who has something particular in mind that I didn't raise or that I kind of overlooked, I'll give you an opportunity to ask it. Please don't give a speech and just ask a short question. And hopefully, as we go through this, we'll be able to address that as well. Yeah?
On number two, where it says the stuff that a Jewish court, my question is, when a person is converted, why is it that Beth Din has three rabbis? How come a woman's not on that?
Okay, it's a similar type of a question to the testimony question. So your question fits perfectly into number two, and we'll try to deal with that.
Two issues that I'd like to see you address. One is Kedusha, and the other one is women reading Torah, which is probably along the same lines, and dancing with the Torah.
Okay.
What's the second one?
Dancing with the Torah.
What was the first one? Kedusha.
Okay, anyone else?
My question is, why is it that it has become the mitzvot that women are exempt from? Sometimes they're discouraged from doing it. It's not just they don't have to, but it seems they shouldn't.
Could you give an example?
For example, it would seem that you have a lot of sort of women's Torah reading prayer communities, but it doesn't really happen that way. Is that a lot of things, that a rabbinic thing, or is that just a custom that's come into place?
So women's prayer groups, is that what you're...
Right, or women's Torah services, women's Tefillah reading, that's sort of a lone example.
Okay.
But why does exempt become discouraged?
If I don't get to that, I'm trying to figure out exactly where to put these things in, so if I don't get to that, remind me at the end, okay?
Laws of occurrence seem somewhat unequal. Why were they designed so unequal? Inheritance.
Yeah, that's one I didn't think of. Okay.
No, I'm not saying why God made it like that.
Right. Okay. Anything else?
How do we know about the oral Torah sites? The written Torah we have a document completely fine. But the oral Torah seems to occasionally vary from rabbi to rabbi.
Okay, so Unfortunately, in this class, we won't be able to discuss the entire process of the Oral Torah. That probably would take an entirely separate class to understand the mechanics of how Oral Torah works. But in a nutshell, there's a system, there's a process, which means that even when there's debate, even when there's argument, there's a process. Oral Torah refers to the Talmud, by the way. So Oral Torah is codified in the Talmud. There's much debate in the Talmud, and much debate on the Talmud, and much debate on those who debate the Talmud. But there's an entire system of how to figure out what it is to pull down to law, and what it is to push off to the side within that. So it's not arbitrarily picking this opinion or choosing that opinion, but rather there's a system in terms of when we choose one opinion, when we ignore the other opinion, and how we're able to codify law through the Talmud. Unfortunately, we don't have time to discuss that in this class. Maybe some other class will be able to get a better understanding in terms of how the Talmud is codified, or what the process was of bringing down the written Torah to the oral Torah, and finally to what we have today. It's much more, it's complicated, obviously, and well beyond the this class.
There's one more.
Why isn't it highlighted, the terminology, being satisfied with your portion? Creation involved man and woman, and there's enough to do for a man, enough to do for a woman, that it occupies their entire life. Generally, what we're talking about is a constant conflict of I want something that you have.
Is this a question? Or okay, maybe we'll discuss. I think I'll touch on that at the very end in the last section. Okay, so I think from what I'm hearing, I think the sentiment is pretty much the same, and that is, we pretty much covered the major areas, the major topics. There were some nuances, some details that I missed along the way, but we'll try to deal with some of them as we go through this. Okay, we're going to have to move somewhat quickly because time is short. My goal, again, is not that you walk out of this room, oh, now I understand everything, all my questions are answered, but at least to give you some food for thought, something to think about as we continue in this process of trying to understand how to advance the role of women in Jewish life. Certainly, and prove to you that it has been advanced majorly throughout the generations, despite what it may look like right now, because you're not comparing it to what was, you're comparing it to what you see out in the world in the United States in 2011. But to be able to show you how there were many advances that were made, again, maintaining the principles of the Torah within a very specific code and just applying it to the times differently as time moves on. Okay, so the first thing that we have to deal with is the assumption of feminism and the assumption of egalitarianism in general. Because I titled this class, All Men Are Created Equal, Women Too. So the real problem with that title is that the statement is also wrong, which means that the All Men Are Created Equal sounded like the assumption, and then the question was women too. But the assumption is also wrong, which means that the Torah doesn't believe in all men are created equal. It doesn't even believe all men are created equal. So then we have to have, if the Torah doesn't believe all men are created equal, it becomes much more complicated to understand equal in what? Equal to do what? Does it mean closer to God? That's so beyond our realm. That we, very seldomly are we dealing with how close are you to God? How close is he to God? Am I closer to God? Are you closer to God? We don't really understand these things. We're dealing with something on a much more practical plane, and with an assumption of all men are created equal, then the question of women too is a very difficult one to answer. But if we show that the assumption is wrong, then we kind of notice that it's not men versus women, it's this group versus this group versus this group versus this group, each one kind of branching off in their own way, each one kind of doing their own thing, and somehow complementing one another and creating an entire society that serves God. See, feminism in the Webster's definition is the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes. On the same plane, egalitarianism is a belief in human equality, especially with respect to social, political, and economic affairs. Now, like we pointed out at the beginning, in all these areas of life, it makes perfect sense. It's perfectly legitimate. In social, political, and economic affairs, to have men and women equal, literally equal, equal in what they're able to do, equal in what they're able to accomplish, equal in their compensation, equal in every which way. But when it comes to religious life, it becomes much more complicated because it's not fighting against society, it's not fighting against a system that was developed maybe by chauvinistic people, but it's fighting against a system that is considered to be a tradition from God. And therefore, we can't fight the system, we have to try to use the system and maybe apply the system in a way where we could be more involved, in a way where we can understand why it is that we're supposed to be doing this and not doing that, but again, not to undermine the system. Now, when we say all men are created equal, all men are created equal to some degree, which means that we know not all men are created equal in their intelligence, not all men are created equal in their skills, not all men are created equal in their abilities, not all men are created equal in what they're able to, what they're able to accomplish and able to achieve. People are able, sometimes people are hardwired in a way where they're able to accomplish more, sometimes hardwired in a way where they're able to accomplish less. All men are not created equal. But we believe in the United States of America that everyone should be given, to some degree, an equal opportunity. A degree of opportunity where they can ultimately, if they put themselves into it and they work hard to ultimately achieve a certain goal, to ultimately achieve success, however that may be defined by different individuals. When it comes to the Torah, when it comes to religious systems, there are preordained classes before we even begin. For example, there are Kohanim. Kohanim are people who are able to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. They're able to serve in the temple. And no matter how hard I try, no matter how motivated I am, no matter how close to God I want to be, I cannot serve. I see the coin smirking. No matter how much I want to be the one serving in that temple, I can't serve in that temple. Does it bother women that they can't be Kohanim? Does it bother men that they can't be Kohanim? Usually not, because that's something which we're able to recognize as a reality of a division of labor. Does it mean the Kohen is better than me? No. Does it mean the Kohen is more important than me? Well, he has this job, which I can't do, and it is an important job, but there are other very important jobs that I could do, and perhaps doing those jobs are as important and maybe even more important than the job that the Kohen is able to do. But ultimately, I'm stuck. I can't do the job of the Kohen. So we find the Kohen is not the only class that we have. We have the class of the Kohen, we have the class of the Levi, we have the class of the Nisim, meaning the leaders of the Jewish people, the scholars. Each one of these classes are treated with a different level of respect. Each one of these classes are treated with a different, with the Kohen is supposed to be getting the first Aliyah. When we walk into Shul, and that, the Kohen is called first to the Torah. Why is the Kohen called first to the Torah? He's better than me. Why should he always be the one who's called first to the Torah? Well, it's usually something that doesn't bother me so much, except when he gets
it. Bothered Korach.
Right? It bothered Korach, which is this week's Parsha. Now, I think that's a very important message that if you think about it, this in this week's Parsha, what happens is Korach is the one who goes over to Moshe and Aaron and says, it's not fair. You're taking all the positions for yourself. And Moshe and Aaron, if you had to explain who Korach was and what his agenda was, Korach basically believed in some level of socialism, some level of communism, where everyone should be equal, everyone should have equal opportunity. Kol ha'eda kulam kedoshim. That was Korach's motto, that everyone is holy. It's not you. It's me and you and him and everyone else. There shouldn't be a leader. It shouldn't be a society that has someone at the top and then another tier and another tier. It should be kikulam kedoshim. We're all the same. But Moshe's response, which was God's response, is that no, it doesn't work like that. We're not all the same. We're not all the same in what? We're not all the same in what we're supposed to be doing in order to be successful in terms of our service to God. We may be all the same ultimately, we may be all the same in terms of the world to come, which is certainly what we believe and why we do everything, but we're not all the same in what we're supposed to get done down here on this world. So, when we talk about feminism and Judaism, it's a very difficult thing, because in social life, in economic life, in political life, I believe in equality as much as the next person, because we're not up against anything divine. We're not up against anything which is sacred. But when we deal with Judaism and we're dealing with the Torah, we're dealing with what God said yes to and what God said no to, it's a very different system. You can't fight City Hall on that one. Are you raising your hand again? Your husband.
Sorry, I'm stretching.
Uh-oh. Okay. So, when it comes to equality, we also have to understand, what does equality mean? Which means that, moving now back to gender, everyone understands ultimately there is a difference between the genders. There's a difference between males and females. Males are cut out to do certain things and females are cut out to do other things. There are certain things and many things and maybe even most things that they're both able to do equally as well. But there are other areas of life where men are incompetent and other areas of life where we wouldn't say women are incompetent, but they may not be as able to do it as well as well. Why are you laughing? As well as men. For example, we would all agree that on a professional sports team, we shouldn't discriminate based on skin color. Right? We would all agree on that? Anyone? We would all agree that skin color should not be something we should discriminate based on. If he's better, he gets on the team. If he's worse, he doesn't get on the team. It doesn't matter if he's white or black. It shouldn't matter how many whites you have on the team or how many blacks you have on the team already. That shouldn't matter either. Somehow we have a little bit of a funny system where that also matters. But In an ideal world, nothing should matter. That should not be something which is looked at all. You don't look at someone's eye color when you give them a job, and you don't look at someone's skin color when you give them a job. And we all agree these are not criteria that should be looked at all. In professional sports as well, we don't look at these criteria. They're irrelevant. They're completely irrelevant. But when it comes to gender, one can't say gender is irrelevant. Irrelevant when it comes to professional sports. Well, what would you suggest? If we ignore gender as we ignore everything else, what would be the result? The result will be, well, the men tend to be more powerful, they tend to be faster, they tend to be stronger, there will be no women tennis players, there will be no women runners, there will be no women jumpers. You'll have one out of, I don't know, 20 on a team. Is that equality? Is that fair? Just taking the best? Well, society has decided, no, that's not fair. Because if one has a predisposition to something, you can't put them in the same group as everyone else. If one has if women in general tend to not be able to compete with men in professional sports, so society recognizes they have to be split. You have to have professional sports for women and you have professional sports for men. You don't put them together. So no matter how much we want to equate the genders and make everyone the same, we all recognize deep down that there are differences. These are physical differences. These are real differences. These are not differences that just are superficial and irrelevant, such as skin tone and eye color, but rather they're very fundamental differences that are recognized by society. And as we move to break down all the ceilings and all the barriers that separate the social classes and the economic divides and the social divides and the political divides between men and women, we understand that there are ultimately always going to be certain divides that we want. And equality really is only achieved when those divides are strong and they stay there, because then women will be able to be successful in what they do and men will be able to be successful in what they do. So Judaism, in many ways, is very similar in that there are jobs for women and there are jobs for men. Most of the jobs are the same, meaning most of religious practice and most of religious life, our minds always focus on the differences. But in most areas, there are no differences. In most areas, in terms of service to God, in terms of our relationship with God, the way we kind of conduct our lives, they are very similar. But there are differences. And the differences are not indicative of something as superficial as skin color, but rather indicative of something much deeper and perhaps much more fundamental within a person, that women would have a tendency to succeed in some area, and therefore those are the jobs that the Torah kind of pushes her to, whereas men may have a tendency to succeed in other areas, so therefore the Torah pushes the man to these other jobs. Now, I found, someone referred me to an article written by this woman named Andrea Kahn. I don't know who she is. She has an article online. You could find it on ish.com. She's a woman who grew up in Los Angeles in a very secular Hollywood-type society. I don't remember exactly what her story was. But as she went down the path and became more religious, she was struggling with one of the major issues that she was struggling with is what she called the female question. And what she writes is like this. I spent many months grappling with the female question. So much of what I saw in the religious way of life seemed at odds with what I thought I knew. But at one point I had to ask myself, what have I been told by my schooling and my society, and what do I really see in the world? What is my experience? My answer: men and women are significantly, dramatically different, emotionally and physically. And now I realize spiritually. Judaism addresses these differences. I looked, really looked, at the religious women around me. I had never met stronger, more emotionally and spiritually refined, capable, loving, non-neurotic, I don't know about that one, women. Or more sensitive, respectful, don't know about that one either, devoted men. Or more happy, physically intact, cared for children, and I wanted that. So what she said is that she was able to overcome her female issues, not so much by realizing that they're not such issues, but rather realizing that somehow the people who managed to overcome in their minds these issues seemed pretty happy, and the people that from the society she was coming from didn't seem all that content and didn't seem all that happy, and she therefore started to gravitate in the other direction. So The point to draw out of this is that as we begin to discuss the different sections of areas where women are different than men, we have to understand that it's not a discriminatory issue. It's not something where the Torah discriminates against women, but rather forces men to channel their energies, which probably otherwise would be channeled in a very negative way, towards this type of service. Whereas the women maybe have a more natural tendency to kind of gravitate towards service of God. You know, when we look at denominations other than Orthodoxy, where women are given full rights in the synagogue and everything else, well, what ends up happening is that there are no men around, because the men will gravitate towards the electronics and the golf course and the movies and the video games and all the other things that take up their time, because women have this type of innate spiritual drive that men probably don't have. And therefore, what we tend to find is that the Torah kind of forces men to do certain things, and those things are like a boys' club, whereas women will naturally gravitate to do what they need to do. So now let's get into some of the details. Torah study and mitzvos. So first of all, are women really exempt from Torah study? It wouldn't make sense to say women are exempt from Torah study, because if a woman doesn't learn, she doesn't know what to do. When we say that a woman is exempt from Torah study, we mean something very, very specific. We don't mean to say that a woman is exempt from Torah study. A woman is obligated to study Torah in order to know what to do. The difference between a man and a woman in Torah study is that after a man knows what to do, he's still obligated in Torah study. Whereas a woman is obligated to study to know what to do, which means that the woman's life, as viewed by the Torah, is a much more practical life, whereas the man's life is a much more theoretical life, which means that the Torah is mandating of a man that you continue to study Torah even in areas that are completely inapplicable, don't apply, not relevant to life, whereas the woman's function is supposed to be to study Torah, to know what to do, to know how to do this, to know how to keep the kitchen kosher, to know how to do this right and that right and the other thing right, to know how to keep the Shabbat, and to know how to do whatever needs to be done. So when we say that a woman is exempt from Torah study, it's a bit of a misnomer. She's exempt from the study of Torah where the irrelevant study of Torah, but the relevant study of Torah, of course she has to study Torah. The halacha is that a woman makes the same blessing on the Torah that a man does in the morning, because they are obligated in a certain sense to study Torah, because they're obligated to study Torah in order to know what to do. When we come to time-bound positive mitzvot, So this is something that many struggle with, and any explanation as to why a woman may be exempt from a time-bound positive mitzvah is really just an explanation as to why she may be exempt from a time-bound positive mitzvah. It's a theory. It's not a fact. The fact is that the Talmud says women are exempt from a time-bound positive mitzvah and learns it out from a very technical source. Why? The why is always a difficult question. In all areas of Judaism, the why is sometimes an unanswered question. It's a question that we struggle with. It's the question that we refer to as Limud HaTorah. It's a question that we refer to as studying Torah, trying to understand, trying to get a better understanding of why God made it this way. But ultimately, that is the answer to that question doesn't change the system. The answer to that question is just a way to understand a little bit better. Ramosha Feinstein suggests, and many others that preceded him suggest, that women are exempt from time-bound positive mitzvahs, he says, because their focus is on the structure or the infrastructure of the home, whether it's single women in their home, whether in the home they're growing up in, or the home that they're creating, whether it's married women with their children. The woman's focus is supposed to be on the infrastructure to make sure that the infrastructure of the home is solid. Now, what bothers everyone with that, and I could ask it so you don't have to ask it, what bothers everyone with that is, one second, there are many women who have the ability to hire others to take care of many of those types of activities. There are many women who are single and don't have children. There are many women who somehow don't need to spend much time on these things because they're extremely capable and they could get everything done, and then they have all this extra free time in their hands. So what about those women? Meaning, wouldn't it make more sense if the system were set up much differently? Women are, if they have a conflict, such as a screaming baby, a husband who's starving, or something that has to get done within the infrastructure of the home, so then she's exempt from the mitzvah of lulav and the mitzvah of tefillin and the mitzvah of this and the mitzvah of that. But if there's no conflict, why in the world would we exempt women from these mitzvos? The system should have been set up differently. So I would like to suggest that the system could not have been set up differently, which means that God wanted to create a system where the infrastructure of, the domestic infrastructure is strong. Now, if God would have gave women, or obligated women, and all these time-bound mitzvot, which have to get done now, and said, you have to do it just as the man has to do it, the woman has to do it as well, what's going to happen with all this infrastructure that has to be built, with all these details that have to be taken care of? Well, you would say, well, I understand. Under those circumstances, I'm exempt. Exempt means that I really want to do that. I'm supposed to be doing that, but I'm kind of exempt. This is more important. God couldn't set up a system like that. That would be extremely destructive to the emotional well-being of any woman if they lived their entire life being told you have to help build the infrastructure of the home, and if you have any free time, if you have any moments to get out and do that mitzvah, you better do it. So that means whenever she's not doing that, whenever she's not getting out to do that time-bound mitzvah that has to get done now, there's going to be a guilt. There's going to be a real Jewish guilt, a feeling of incompetency and a feeling of loss and inability to do what she really should be getting done. It will put that much more on her plate. The only way that God could have set up a system to make sure that women would be able to focus on building the infrastructure of a home, and then, fine, after that's done, after that's taken care of, go and do mitzvos, is to exempt women from those mitzvos, all women from those mitzvos, regardless of whether you have this burden or don't have the burden. Because if you exempt some of the women, what are we going to exempt? Married women from these mitzvos and not unmarried women? So then women are going to feel that same guilt. They're going to feel like, I really should be doing it, but okay, now I'm exempt because of my situation. It's not like that. God has created a system where women are going to feel that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, and they don't need to worry about those things. If they have time to deal with them, if they have some leisure time where they want to do a mitzvah, such as shaking a lulav and esrog, or hearing shofar and shul, instead of tending to whatever it is they have to tend to, good. They'll do that, and they'll get reward for it, but they should never feel that it's an obligation. one of the things that people struggle with is the minyan, the counting women in a minyan. But really, it falls right under this heading. It's really within the same category, and that is that a minyan means that there has to be a minyan in shul three times a day. There's an obligation to pray, and one is supposed to be praying with a minyan three times a day. So that means that if women would be obligated to count, would count in a minyan, they would also have a demand, meaning when you make the phone calls in shul, because you only have 9 and you're looking for 10, when you start making those phone calls, you're going to make those phone calls pulling women away from their children, pulling women out of their homes from what they're doing, from what they're organizing, from what they're preparing, and it would create an absolute chaos in Judaism, because the spiritual demands would be completely destructive to the domestic demands. And therefore, by exempting women, by saying women can't count for a minyan, what you're essentially doing is freeing them up from these types of obligations so that they could focus on other areas of importance. It's not even, say, as important. It's essential. Areas that are absolutely essential to be built and to be solid. If you're going to put this type of demand on a woman, so what you're going to end up doing is pulling her away from those types of areas, from building that infrastructure. And therefore, what you're going to ultimately cause is a collapse of that infrastructure. So when we talk about women's prayer groups, so women's prayer groups may be a nice thing, but it's not within the framework of halacha, in the sense that it doesn't contribute anything more to davening with a prayer group than to davening in your home. Which means that if a woman is gonna daven with a minyan, so there is an idea of davening in a synagogue, in the context of a synagogue, together with a proper minyan. If a woman is going to daven in a, there's no halachic reality of 10 women in a prayer group. It's a nice thing. It's nothing wrong with it in the sense of women davening together, women davening separately, but it also doesn't contribute anything. It doesn't add anything. So to turn something which really doesn't have much significance into significance is also something which becomes problematic, because it gives a false impression of what the demands really are. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, when he discusses these issues, he puts tremendous emphasis on saying that the Kedusha, the levels of holiness, it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. He says he couldn't find anywhere in the Torah where the Torah indicates men are holier than women, or men have a closer relationship to God than women. These are all, everything we're dealing with is on a very practical plane. It's in a very real world in terms of jobs and obligations and things that have to get done. We're not dealing with afterlife. We're not dealing with closeness to God and things in the spiritual and metaphysical world. Going down to the next section, one of the things that we do is we thank Hashem for not making me a woman. Baruch atah Hashem shelo asani isha. That bracha, that blessing, sounds very derogatory. But if we look at the sources and we look at what we're trying to do with those brachos, it really comes after another two brachos that preceded, and there's a specific focus on those when one makes those blessings. The first blessing one makes is, thank you God for not making me a non-Jew. Thank you God for not making me a slave. Thank you God for not making me a woman. So now it sounds even more derogatory. No. So the idea behind those three blessings are like this. That what you're doing is, you're thanking, what a man is doing when he makes these blessings, is he's thanking God for giving him the opportunity to fulfill more mitzvot. Now, women don't have this opportunity, men have the opportunity. It's a reality. Women don't have the opportunity. Women have the opportunity to do the mitzvot, but they're not commanded in the mitzvot. So what a man is doing when he makes these blessings is, thank you for not making me a non-Jew, who is exempt from all mitzvot. Thank you for not making me an eved, who is obligated in some mitzvot, a slave, but exempt from other mitzvot. And thank you for not making me a woman, who is exempt from some mitzvot, and making me more obligated in mitzvot. And if you look at the commentaries on these blessings, the focus is not on the gender. The focus is really on the mitzvot. It's a very mitzvah oriented blessing, and the system is the sequence of the three blessings is a very mitzvah oriented sequence. The blessing that women make of Shasani Kiritsono, that God made me according to His will, that's a very difficult blessing, and that's a hard one to understand. You should know that that blessing is not found in the Talmud. The way that's brought down in the sources, the Tur, who was from the Rishonim period, let's say from the 1200s, 1300s, let's say, so the Tur was one of the first ones to mention this blessing, and he doesn't even mention it as, I mean, this was, you know, it sounds like men make the blessing of, thank you for not making me a woman. Women make the blessing of, God, you made me the way you wanted to. So the Tur says that blessing is not found in the Talmud. The Tur says that blessing was nohagu hanashim, to say this blessing, that the women kind of decided among themselves to start. They're missing a blessing. Thank you. They're missing a blessing in the morning, and they wanted to fill that in with something else, and they started making this blessing as a recognition of Hashem, you made me also according to your will. If we contrast that with the blessing of Shelo Asani Isha, it sounds derogatory, but it seems to me that it's not supposed to be in contrast. It's not like the rabbis decided, oh, men should make Shelo Asani Isha, thank you for not making me a woman, and women should make the blessing of, you made me the way you wanted to. They weren't developed at the same time. There was a blessing for women, I'm sorry, for men. Women couldn't make that blessing because they are women, it's Shelo Asani Isha, and they obviously couldn't make that blessing, and therefore they filled it in, it says, with another blessing, with a blessing of Shasani Kiritsono, recognizing that God made me according to His will, with the abilities that I have to do to serve God in the ways that I have to serve God, even if it's not in the in the ability to do more mitzvos. Okay, we're gonna have to move a little faster over here, and maybe skip around a little bit. Often people assume that the rabbis of the Talmud are derogatory or demeaning to women. If you think about it, the rabbis of the Talmud, for the most part, did things to protect women in a way where, in societies where women were much more abused, and it was only in the Jewish societies where the women had this type of protection. For example, the rabbis of the Talmud introduced this concept called a ksuba. What's a ksuba? A ksuba is a document that when a couple gets married, the woman was always at risk of being thrown out with nothing. The ksuba was designed as a document to protect women and be there as almost like a penalty, that if there is going to be a divorce, it's going to cost him. He's going to have to pay out a significant sum of money, and therefore what it ultimately does is it prevents this rash or thoughtless type of situation where there's domestic fighting and the woman is kind of thrown out into the streets in a society where women were not working, they did not have jobs, they weren't given social and economic equality, and basically would be left with nothing. The rabbis of the Talmud came along and introduced this idea of a ksuba. Another thing that they introduced, and this is also very very interesting if you think about it, Rabbeinu Gershom was post the Talmudic era. He instituted it's called a cherem, two institutions of Rabbeinu Gershom that had to complement one another. I do a lot of religious divorces, so sometimes women say, is it true that the man could divorce the husband, I'm sorry, the man could divorce the wife against her will, and the woman can't divorce the husband against his will? So on some level there's truth to that, but on a practical level it's not true. Because Rabbeinu Gershom came along and he said that although by Torah law the man plays the active role in both marriage and divorce, and therefore he marries the woman, she says yes or no, and then he kind of relinquishes her to go and be on her way to marry someone else, and that's the way the Torah law is set up. The rabbis of the Talmud came along, not the rabbis of the Talmud, Rabbeinu Gershom came along and said, this is not good. We can't have a system where the man has complete dominance and the man is in complete control to decide when to divorce her and when not to divorce her. So what did he do? He came up with a brilliant system. He said like this, if I just institute that a woman could, that a man can't divorce his wife against her will, well, what's his agenda? He doesn't care. Divorce or don't divorce her, he wants to marry this other woman. So he'll, because, remember, we're not talking with a default of 2011, we're talking with a default of ancient societies where it was perfectly acceptable, polygamy was perfectly acceptable. Therefore, Fine, I won't divorce her. I won't divorce her against her will. I'll just go marry someone else. Rabbeinu Gershom came and made this cherem. He made this institution which protected the woman. How? Well, he said two things. Number one, you can't divorce her against your will. And number two, you can't marry anyone else. You're stuck. You can't. Meaning, you want to divorce her because you found someone that you want to marry, you found someone that you now decide you like better. Well, you're stuck. You can't divorce her against her will, and you also can't marry someone else. By those two institutions, he gave the same equality to a woman as to the man, which means that he made him just as stuck as she is, in the sense that you're now forced to sit down at a table and work things out. You're forced to negotiate. You're forced to deal with things and come up with some settlement where the divorce is able to, where you're able to separate amicably and able to separate in a way where you'll both be walking away with something. And in truth, in the modern society, the ksuba becomes irrelevant because for all intents and purposes, it is irrelevant. It's a document that's done in the time of the marriage, but it's not paid much attention to at the time of divorce because there are other rights that women have nowadays by law that compensate for those monetary issues. In terms of trust, when we talk about a woman not being believed.
Question for the previous thing. So a man who doesn't give a gift cannot marry.
Right. When it comes to women being trusted, so the tendency is to assume that the reason a woman can't testify in a Jewish court is because the Torah doesn't trust her as much. There's nothing further from the truth. Actually, when you invite me over to your house and I sit down and eat, how do I know the food is kosher? Because you tell me it's kosher. Otherwise, I don't know it's kosher. You tell me it's kosher. How do I know that you're believed to tell me it's kosher? There's no two witnesses telling me it's kosher. Why are you believed to tell me it's kosher? The answer is, it's a concept of Eid Echa Nemen Bisurin, that a single witness is believed outside of a courtroom. A single witness is believed in these types of areas. Well, what's the source of Eid Echa Nemen Bisurin? So the source of Eid Echa Nemen Bisurin, Tosfos writes, is learned from the fact that a woman is believed in or is in charge of her process when it comes to going to the mikveh and whatever else it takes for her to become pure, to become ritually clean in that sense. She's completely in charge of that process, and the man is obligated to believe her. So that becomes the source of believability in halacha all over the place, which means, how do you know you can trust me? Because the Torah says that you can trust women. The Torah says you can trust women, then the Torah says you can trust me, you can trust women, meaning a woman is the source for Eid Echa Nemen Bisurin, for this concept. So to say that the reason the Torah doesn't believe a woman in a courtroom is because she's not trusted, there's nothing further from the truth. She's the source of believability. She's the source that a person is trusted in Judaism is learned from a woman. So it can't be that a woman is not believed in a courtroom because we think she's going to be lying, or we don't believe she's going to be telling us accurately or descriptively the information that we need to know. So why is a woman not believed in a courtroom? So this really brings us back to what we said earlier, and that is that when we talk about why women are exempt from mitzvahs asei shehazman grama, from time-bound positive mitzvahs, whatever the theory is, they're exempt from time-bound positive mitzvahs because they have other things to do that are more pressing. There's a conflict with their time, and they can't be available at every moment to run, drop everything, and go do mitzvahs. Well, they can't be available at every moment to drop everything and go testify in a court. A court system has to have in it the system has to contain the concept of subpoenaing people to court, of forcing people to testify if they know testimony. If you have a court system where people are, it's optional. If I want to testify, I'll testify. If I don't want to testify, I won't testify. There's no justice in such a system because there will be bribery and complete distortion within such a system. In order for the system to survive, it has to be either you must testify or you're not permitted to testify. There can't be any category where there's optional testimony, because if there's optional testimony, then it breaks down the system. If I like that person, I'll testify. If I don't like that person, I won't testify. It takes away the justice of the system. And therefore, to say that a woman is not believed in a court because she's not believed, no. She's not believed in a court because she has conflicts with her time, and because we can't demand that she testifies due to those conflicts, we can't allow her to testify, because if we have a system where we allow testimony and can't demand that testimony, we lose the entire justice of the system.
With all due respect, that doesn't make sense. Because if you have a situation where most of the witnesses are women, then how are you going to get testimony?
Very good. So that's a very important point. Let's say you have a situation where there are no men around. So the way this happened in halachic literature was in a women's section in a synagogue. There was something that went on. I forgot exactly what the situation was. There was something that went on, whether it was a crime, a theft, or something. And there were no men to testify because it was a women's section of a synagogue. And what are you supposed to do under such circumstances? So it is brought in halacha. It is brought in Shulchan Aruch that this is under circumstances where the situation happens in an area where only women are going to be privy to that information. Whether it's sometimes it's not just because of the scene, sometimes it's because of the issue involved. Whether it's a sexual issue that only women would be privy to that information, in areas where only women are going to be privy to the information, and men are likely not to be there or not are likely not to be privy to that information. So it's brought in the Ramah, who is the kind of the father figure of Ashkenazi custom, that under those circumstances we admit the testimony of women into court as two witnesses, and we admit their testimony and we will prosecute according to their testimony. Why? Because it's a situation where otherwise you won't have justice. Otherwise it's not possible for men. It's not just a circumstance where there happens to be no men there and a woman saw it, but it's a situation, it's a category where men are not going to know are not going to have information in this area. So under those circumstances, you have to subpoena women, you're able to subpoena women, and you're able to admit the testimony of women as well.
Can I just ask one question?
Yeah.
I guess, how do you explain then, in a civil court, women can be subpoenaed, women testify, how is it possible that they are allowed then under religious law to go to a civil court if they have their obligations in the home?
So what we're discussing is not, there's no prohibition in the sense of a woman going to testify in a situation. See, the laws are set up sometimes differently. The law of a woman testifying was never set up as a prohibition on the woman to testify. It was set up as a system. The system of law doesn't admit, in general circumstances, the testimony of women. There was no prohibition ever placed on a woman to testify. So if a woman, if you find yourself in a system where the testimony of a woman is admissible into court, there's no prohibition, there's nothing wrong at all with a woman going to testify. What we're trying to understand over here, and again, not trying to explain every nuance, but trying to get some understanding and struggle with, is the general Torah system of why it would have been set up this way. It's true, we live in a society which is very hard to relate to, and it's not set up this way, and things play out much, much differently. There's no prohibition on a woman to go to testify in the society that we live on. I'm just trying to give some perspective on why in kind of like the Torah system, you would have such a situation. I think we really have to come to a close now. It's getting too late. I'm going to skip a little bit. We had something on about modesty. Much of the prejudices that we find in modesty in those areas of law have to do with not so much the women, but have to do a lot with the men and the tendencies of men. And it doesn't seem so fair to say that women have to be more modest because men are such animals, but ultimately that's it has a lot to do with that. It's kind of recognizing the way God created different creatures, and recognizing that God made men with this kind of desire and this thing called testosterone, and makes things much more difficult when women are not going to be dressed modestly. But we also recognize that, you know, one of the agendas of feminism itself is not to view women as objects, as sexual objects. Well, the best way to avoid that type of discrimination and that type of turning a woman into something, into an item, as opposed to an individual, an intelligent individual who has what to offer, is a certain level of modesty. But we don't have time, unfortunately, to develop that much. In general, we find that sometimes a lot of these issues, a lot of the feminism issues, are motivated through passion and a desire to become closer to God, to come closer to God, and to grow closer to God, and become a better person. And this kind of passion motivates a person, whether it's motivating them in being more involved in the synagogue or motivating them in other areas. It's very important to recognize, and the passion is not bad, but the passion has to be controlled in the sense that service to God is not relegated by the servant. Service to God is relegated by God. And therefore, when God wants something, we can consider that serving Him with passion as an ideal way to serve God. When God doesn't want something, or doesn't care that much about something, then no matter how passionate I may be to provide that for Him, if He doesn't want a glass of water right now, bringing Him a glass of water is not going to be considered a service to God. So we have to be very careful to understand that what God wants, as we interpret from the Torah, is a certain type of service and a certain rigidity in the service, and we should be doing that with passion. But passion can't be the motivating factor of how we decide what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. We just read this past week's Torah portion, after God told all the Jews, you cannot come into the land of Israel, these spies messed up royally, and therefore you can't come into the land of Israel, you're going to be stuck in the desert for 40 years. There was a group called the Ma'afilim that said, no, we're going anyway. They were passionate people. They were people who were strong and people who were determined, we're going to go anyway. Moshe Rabbeinu warned them, you can't go, because if you go, you're going to be destroyed and you're going to be killed. And that's what happened. They were motivated by passion, and they were trying to impose this passion on God, meaning, we're serving you, God, accept it. But it doesn't work like that. Unfortunately, passion is the response to God asking for something. We can respond with a passionate response, but we can't decide through our passion what God should be accepting from us and what God should want. Let's end with this last point, and that is, does halacha evolve to accommodate women? And the answer to that question is unequivocally yes, but very, very slowly. The answer to the question is, halacha does evolve to some degree. It does move in a certain direction to try to accommodate for the times, but it's very important, since we have to remember that these are not social principles, these are not economic principles, these are divine principles. We have to make sure not to step on God's toes as we move forward, and we have to be very careful to make sure that we don't undermine principles that already exist. We find that in the Talmud already, it says that sometimes they permitted certain things. The Talmud says in Maseches Chagiga, lasos nachas ruach lenashim, to accommodate the women when in a certain sacrifice issue where women wanted to be involved in the mitzvah of smicha, which is kind of putting their hands on the animal's head, which is a process which is done in the bringing of a korban, of a sacrifice. So it says in the Talmud that women were technically not obligated to do this thing yet, and not supposed to for other reasons, but the rabbis kind of pushed the envelope a little bit. Kedei lasos nachas ruach lenashim. So we do find a precedent for this idea when there is a passion and a woman wants to become more involved and wants to be able to do to channel her desire to come close to God. There does have to be a response, and slowly but surely the Jewish society, even the very religious society, recognizes this. Whether it involves women's education, which has come a long, long way over a relatively short, very short period of time, in a way where women are extremely learned nowadays, and you're talking about not so long ago, a few hundred years ago, where they were completely illiterate. So there was there were many strides made already in this area. The most important thing to remember is that the attention is only given when the motivation is considered to be a proper motivation. Moshe Feinstein has a very that's the last thing I printed out. We don't have time to go through it, but he has a very interesting response to this issue of feminism, and his main point in his argument is that the motivation has to be a proper motivation. It can't be a motivation of I'll tell God what or God is unfair or God should be treating me somewhat differently. It has to be a proper motivation. He writes that if a woman would do a time-bound positive mitzvah because she wants to do that time-bound positive mitzvah, that is a great service to God and she'll get reward for this. But he writes that if she does it because of her complaints against God, why did you make men obligated in this mitzvah and not make me obligated in this mitzvah? That's a complaint against God and on his Torah. He says, what you do is you take this act of a mitzvah and you make it so mundane that it's not a mitzvah at all, and it becomes an act of rejection against God because you're doing it with an approach of not trying to serve God, but trying to tell God how he should be served. So this is a very important message, I guess, to take out of this class, and that is that passion is good, motivation is good, getting more involved is good, but, you know, as we're dealing with an ancient system, we're dealing with a divine system, and we're dealing with a very rigid set of rules, that as time goes on, as society changes, as women become more involved in the society, things are changing. You may not see it, but if you compare what was to what is, then you see a very stark contrast. And it's just important that it change very slowly, because you're not dealing with voting and driving and a pay scale. You're dealing with things that are much deeper than that and much greater than that. Thank you for coming.